Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present James Ross, Legal and Policy Director with Human Rights Watch, who discusses the final days of Sri Lanka's civil war and the current investigation into war crimes. Jim Schultz of the Democracy Center in Cochabamba, Bolivia, who assesses the potential rewards and dangers of lithium mining and production for the impoverished people of Bolivia. And John Atlas, public interest lawyer and organizer, who talks about his new book, Seeds of Change, the story of ACORN, America's most controversial anti-poverty community organizing group. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
A huge wealth gap between blacks and whites in the United States has ballooned over the past 25 years. A study of the Institute of Assets and Social Policy at Brandeis University found a typical white middle-class family owns five times the financial assets and wealth as the typical black middle-class family. The study, which tracked 2,000 families since 1984, found a quarter of black families had no financial assets at all. The study did not measure the rise and fall of housing values owned by black and white families, which is harder to track than other assets like stocks and bonds. Currently, the top 1% of the U.S. population owns 40% of the country's wealth, and the top quarter of families own over 85% of all financial assets. In contrast, a third of the African Americans do not have a pension to pay for retirement. The Brandeis study also found that African Americans and Latinos were more likely to be sold risky and higher interest rate mortgages during the recent housing boom. 2 years ago, the Libertarian Nevada Policy Research Institute took a new approach to uncovering dirt on the Las Vegas Convention and Visitors Authority. The research group hired investigative reporter John Doherty to do the digging. Doherty uncovered a pattern of extravagant spending, lax accounting, and shady oversight at the Convention Authority. The report on the abuses caused a stir in the local media and prompted the Convention Authority to reform its management practices. An increasing number of out-of-power conservatives are now trying their hand at investigative reporting as a tactic to push their agenda. According to the Washington Monthly magazine, the Daily Caller website, founded by media pundit Tucker Carlson, exposed a scandal at the Republican National Committee when the party was found to have paid a $2,000 bar tab at a bondage-themed Los Angeles nightclub. Also, the conservative Texas watchdog website teamed up with the Center for Public Integrity to expose how serial rapists on college campuses go unpunished. But in their new vocation, conservatives will have to overcome their own history of doing sloppy, politically driven hit jobs. The Arkansas Project, targeting Bill Clinton in the 1990s, and the more recent misleading ACORN videos shot by conservative activist James O'Keefe will make it difficult for conservatives to be taken seriously as credible investigative reporters. First Lady Michelle Obama created quite a splash when she planted an organic garden on the White House lawn and invited local school children to pick the first crop. But new enthusiasm for going organic has not helped upstate New York farmer Max Pitts, who earns an average of $7 an hour despite selling his vegetables to eager customers twice a week at New York City's Union Square Farmers Market. According to the American Prospect magazine, the U.S. Department of Agriculture is still dominated by big agricultural interests, devoting its efforts to the export of commodity crops. Similarly, the USDA has allocated most of the agency's $134 billion budget to farm subsidies for corporate agriculture while failing to assist small farmers transition to sustainable practices. Organic advocates give the Obama administration credit for hiring good people to run the government's organic program, which has begun to bring criminal cases against farmers who are abusing organic standards. But Obama has been criticized by environmentalists for appointing biotech industry insiders to key policy positions. For example, Islam Siddiqui, the chief agricultural negotiator for the U.S. Trade Office, previously worked at CropLife America, the farm chemical trade group. the same group which criticized Michelle Obama for not using crop protection chemicals in her White House vegetable garden. Predictably, Republican Senators John McCain, Saxby Chambliss, and Pat Roberts are opposed to Obama's modest efforts to promote organic produce. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Indu Anand.
More than a quarter century of civil war between the Tamil Tiger rebels and the Sinhalese majority government ended in Sri Lanka in May 2009. While human rights advocates had been concerned for years about rights violations and possible war crimes committed by both sides, they were shocked and alarmed when they learned that several thousand Tamil civilians had been killed as the Sri Lankan army launched its final offensive to defeat the rebels. After its failure to pressure Sri Lanka's government to undertake a serious investigation of these alleged human rights violations, United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon appointed a panel of experts to advise him on procedure in determining responsibility for possible war crimes. Many in Sri Lanka view the three-member panel appointed by Ban as a violation of its sovereignty. In early July, opponents organized hunger strikes and protests at the UN's offices in Colombo. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with James Ross, legal and policy director with Human Rights Watch, who discusses the final days of Sri Lanka's civil war and the current investigation into war crimes.
What you had in the final months of the armed conflict is that the Tamil Tigers were being defeated during the last year of the war, and they retreated to an area along the coast. And as they retreated, they forced to go along with them the Tamil civilians that had been under their control. So they were effectively using the Tamil civilian population as a human shield. At the same time, particularly in the final months of the fighting, you had the Sri Lankan army that was really shelling and attacking the Tamil Tigers, but they were doing so without any regard for the civilian population. So you had at least 7,000 or so civilians who died, perhaps many more. But you had both sides who were acting improperly. You had the Tigers who wouldn't let these civilians leave, and then you had the Sri Lankan government that was indiscriminately shelling and dropping bombs on this population. So it was really horrific, and both sides had a lot to blame. After the war, you did have the Tamils, the 300,000 or so Tamils, who had been caught up in the fighting. They were sent to camps by the Sri Lankan army, and they were under very difficult conditions. Most of those Tamils, though, were able to leave the camps at the end of last year, in part because of significant pressure from the international community.
I understand that there have been calls for years that Sri Lanka investigate alleged human rights abuses by both sides, but that it hasn't done that. So how did this UN investigation come about?
Now, when the fighting ended in May of 2009, there was renewed cause that because of the numerous reports of war crimes during the last few months of the fighting, that there had to be an investigation. The Secretary General Ban Ki-moon of the United Nations went to Sri Lanka after the fighting, and he was told by the Sri Lankan President, Mahinda Rajapaksa, that there would be investigations. So this was in May 2009. Ever since then, there has been really no serious steps taken by the Sri Lankan government to investigate, let alone prosecute anyone for war crimes on both sides in the final months of the fighting. And given the Sri Lankan government's poor record of doing this, the cause for an international investigation have increased. Unfortunately, though, no steps, serious steps, have been taken in that regard. Recently, however, the Secretary General announced that he was creating a panel of experts that wouldn't actually conduct an investigation into war crimes, but would advise him on the various steps that could, in fact, be taken to examine what happened and conduct investigations. So it's really just the body that says, here, this is a blueprint, this is what you're supposed to do, or this is what could be done either by the Sri Lankan government or the international community. And that's what Secretary General Ban recently announced. And he appointed three individuals to this panel, and they're actually quite excellent. It's a strong panel, and we were hoping that the Sri Lankan government would support such an effort, but they've actually condemned and attacked Secretary General Ban for organizing this panel of experts.
So, Jim Ross, where do things stand now? Is it true that a country can't be investigated if it refuses to cooperate?
For an investigation, you would need the Commission of Inquiry, say, to go to the country to do a real criminal investigation, and that would be needed. But this body and the Sri Lankan government has already said, we're not going to allow this group to come to Sri Lanka. But the point is, this panel of experts is not a commission of inquiry. They're not supposed to decide whether war crimes are actually committed or not. Their job really is a very short-term one, in a matter of, they've been given 4 months, and really they're just supposed to give advice to the Secretary General. Now, the advice that they might give, and that we would hope that they would give, would be that there is indeed a need for an international impartial commission of inquiry to look at alleged war crimes by both sides. And then once they've done that, hopefully there'll be support for that, not only from the Secretary General, but concerned governments like the United States, the United Kingdom, and France, that would put pressure on the Sri Lankan government to agree to have such a commission of inquiry. Governments have a legal obligation to investigate abuses that occur on their own soil, and we would want them to do that. Sri Lanka is a country, you know, with actually a pretty good justice system and lawyers and judges and the like, but the government has shown no real inclination to investigate. The Sri Lankan government announced in May the new commission, called the Lessons Learned and Reconciliation Commission, which they have tried to portray as being a Sri Lankan government commission of inquiry. However, by the terms of its own mandate, this Lessons Learned Commission really is just looking at the failure of the 2002 ceasefire and other things. But it itself does not have powers under Sri Lankan law to conduct a real investigation.
That was James Ross, Legal and Policy Director with Human Rights Watch. Contact the group at area code 212-290-4700 or visit their website at hrw.org. Bolivia is the poorest nation in South America, but has a proud history of militant protest by its citizens, demanding the nationalization of the country's energy resources to benefit the impoverished indigenous majority. That same progressive force elected Evo Morales of the Movement Towards Socialism Party, Bolivia's president, in 2005, and he quickly took control of the nation's oil and gas industries. Now, with the world searching for alternatives to polluting fossil fuels, whose CO2 emissions are one of the principal causes of global climate change, Bolivia's vast deposits of the mineral lithium are attracting international attention. Lithium, a likely key component for the manufacture of advanced batteries necessary to power a new generation of carbon-neutral electric cars, could prove to be a significant future source of wealth for poor Bolivians. A recent report of similar large deposits of lithium and other valuable minerals in Afghanistan released by the Pentagon was viewed by many as a bit of propaganda to rally fading support for the war. A report titled Bolivia and Its Lithium, Can the Gold of the 21st Century Lift a Nation Out of Poverty?, published by the Democracy Center in May, examines the economic potential, environmental costs, and foreign capital necessary to launch a large-scale lithium mining project in Bolivia. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Jim Schultz, Executive Director of the Democracy Center in Cochabamba, Bolivia, who assesses the rewards and dangers of lithium mining and production for the people of Bolivia.
You know, Bolivia shares the characteristics of being the most indigenous country in all of the Americas and the poorest country in South America. And the irony of that, of course, is that Bolivia has sat on one chair of gold after another. There's a hill here in Bolivia called Cerro Rico, Rich Hill, which is not a very big mountain, and for over 200 years, that hill virtually bankrolled the Spanish Empire with silver. And so, you know, Bolivia is ground zero for the theft model of resource development. And the same thing happened later with tin and the tin barons. It happened with the privatization of the country's gas and oil under pressure from the World Bank and IMF in the 80s and 90s, the heyday of the Washington Consensus. And so here we are in 2010, and Bolivia is sitting on the largest single source on the planet of lithium. Listeners who were Star Trek fans remember lithium crystals powering Starship Enterprise. Well, it turns out that automakers are looking to lithium to power electric vehicles, so that, you know, that plug-in Toyota Prius that people in the northeast of the United States might be dreaming of off into the near future may require lithium that comes from Bolivia. So on the surface, it's a really interesting opportunity, because here's Bolivia that once again finds itself sitting on a chair of gold in terms of natural resources, but now at a time in which it has a president, Evo Morales, who's signaled very clearly that the old ways of doing things are not the new ways of doing things, that the theft model of resource development is not an option, that Bolivia intends to make sure that it makes the money off its lithium by controlling it and by getting its hands in industrialization of the product. Because, you know, it's economics 101 that if you're sitting on a natural resource, the way you make the money is not selling it off as raw product. It's by making stuff with it. You know, Evo has said that he wants to make, if not cars, certainly batteries. So that's the surface. But when you dig deeper, which is what we did in our report, which is available for free for anybody who wants it on the Democracy Center website, the story, of course, is much more complicated.
In the report, you talk about the resource curse, where you have the paradox of the potential wealth, but also the potential drawbacks of corruption and environmental devastation that we've seen in the development of other resources around the world. I guess we can only look at the Gulf of Mexico today to see some example of that. But certainly, as you said before, there's a colonial heritage in Bolivia that has really not helped the people of Bolivia at all when it came to mining other resources, natural gas in the past, until some recent changes by Evo Morales as president.
Well, you know, the resource curse is an idea that's been around for a long time, and it's a pretty simple analysis, which is if you look at what happens when you have an impoverished country, Bolivia, Chad, any of these countries, and you look at what happens when it finds a treasure of mineral wealth under the ground, the fact is that it ends up almost always being worse off than if it had found, you know, plastic under the ground. Why? First of all, because of corruption, it tends to not actually benefit the people. I mean, you think about how exposed a country that pays very little to its civil servant, the exposure to corporate corruption is enormous. Secondly, I hate to sort of put it in this way, but it's the easiest metaphor to use. If you've ever been to one of those, you know, public plazas, whether it's in Boston or Cochabamba, where there's a whole lot of pigeons looking for food, throw a loaf of bread. The scramble of the pigeons to get the piece is incredible. And whenever you take a country where people are desperate for any kind of economic opportunity and suddenly you hold out the opportunity that there might be some real wealth, the conflicts that erupt are just extraordinary. And we've had that here in this country over gas and oil. In Chad, in Cameroon, you have literally a civil war over oil. So it's very difficult. What the Bolivian government is trying to do here is very difficult in terms of trying to break the resource curse. They may succeed, they may not, but that's really what's at stake here. I would also say one other thing, because you mentioned the Gulf, and we've said that in our presentations here in Bolivia, that one thing we can learn from what's going on in the Gulf is that wealth and access to the highest levels of technology are absolutely not a guarantee of safety from an environmental disaster. I think that we've learned that once again in the Gulf of Mexico. And you take a country like Bolivia, where the money is much less and the access to technology is much less, I think that even raises the stakes higher in terms of the potential environmental consequences.
That was Jim Schultz, Executive Director of the Democracy Center in Cochabamba, Bolivia. Visit the center's website at democracyctr.org to read a copy of their lithium report. ACORN, the Association of Community Organizations for Reform Now, had long been a target of the Republican Party and conservative activists for their successful voter registration drives, effective organizing on fair housing issues, and living wage campaigns. The 40-year-old group, with 400,000 members and offices in 75 cities, was frequently under attack by right-wing commentators and politicians whose unfounded charges were often reported unchallenged in the corporate media. Persistent allegations that ACORN had committed voter fraud, which helped elect Barack Obama president in 2008, were found to be baseless. But when conservative activists James O'Keefe and Hannah Giles, posing as a pimp and prostitute, released edited covert videotapes last fall, purportedly showing ACORN staff offering the phony couple assistance to establish a brothel for underage girls, right-wing groups immediately demanded an investigation and the defunding of the group. Congress quickly complied, passing resolutions that cut off federal funds and sealing the fate of the group, which announced its demise in March. In his new book, Seeds of Change, The Story of ACORN, America's Most Controversial Anti-Poverty Community Organizing Group, John Atlas, public interest lawyer and organizer, examines the group's successes and flaws, providing an honest assessment of its contributions to organizing America's working poor families. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Atlas, who discusses important chapters in ACORN's history covered in his book, and the failure of progressive activists to come to its aid when it mattered most.
The story of ACORN begins with Wade Rathke, who grew up in the South in the 50s and 60s, and it was a period of time when there was widespread resistance to school integration. And he then dropped out of Williams College, and he drops out in order to pursue his dream of organizing poor people so that they could build a powerful organization and help lift themselves out of poverty. Now, he comes out of the welfare rights movement, which is a single-issue group focused on just welfare recipients fighting for welfare rights. One constituency, very poor, fighting one issue. He realizes that that's not going anywhere for the poor that he wants to help. And so he decides to build this a multi-issue, cross-class organization that represents a majority of American people, because he thinks that is the only way you can make a significant difference on behalf of the poor as well as the other millions of people who are less powerful than our large corporations.
In its 40 years, ACORN worked on any number of fronts. They did neighborhood organizing. They worked a lot in housing and giving people who couldn't afford housing access to buy their own homes, living wage campaigns, voter registration drives that they were enormously successful at. Outline some of the most significant successes that ACORN had during its time.
A couple of good examples. ACORN is probably more responsible for an increase in the minimum wage, which basically meant millions and millions of people were getting wage increases, and forced in 2007, forced President Bush, against his will, to sign an increase in the minimum wage. That's an enormous exercise in power. And they also passed dozens of living wage ordinances. Those are also tough to get. You're up against powerful corporate interests who have a vested interest in keeping wages at poverty levels. A third example is an amazing battle that they had with the Household Finance Corporation, a predatory loan operation that was making, you know, $15 billion in loans in 1999, 2000. But they were doing this by ripping off people with these predatory subprime loans. And ACORN organized a national campaign mobilizing 50 state attorneys general to join ACORN in a lawsuit, which resulted in $600 million returned to the people who were ripped off by household finance. They could not do this unless they were a national organization. One of the things that it's so hard to do in a short interview is to give you the drama behind how hard each one of these battles is. But that's some examples.
When it came to the final act in ACORN's 40-year life, conservative activist James O'Keefe and his friend Hannah Giles, they did this editing of videotape, which in the end turned out to be not an honest representation of what happened when these two posed as a prostitute and her pimp trying to get help from ACORN. But more importantly, how could this whole scandal have played out differently so that ACORN could have survived?
The reality is, at this time in our history, there is a powerful conservative media that framed the debate as, did ACORN engage in helping a prostitute get a brothel? Did ACORN engage in voter fraud? That was the only question that the media was asking, instead of the questions that they should have asked, which was, were any of these things factually true? And the mainstream media is severely guilty of failing to do actual reporting, going into communities and trying to determine what actually happened. So the only way that this could have turned out differently was if there was a powerful progressive movement that said, you know, we're not going to let one of our own, one of maybe the most significant progressive organization in the last four decades, to go down. We're going to defend it, we're going to find out what happened, and then we're going to put pressure on politicians and the media and save ACORN.
Now with the dissolution of ACORN this past March, what is likely to rise out of the ashes of ACORN that can stand up and do some of the same work that this group did over the past four decades?
Well, the good news is that the 16 states and the New England region, there are many of the old ACORN organizers, there are allies, there are people who like the ACORN model, and they are resurrecting the old ACORN model community organizations with its focus on going door-to-door, organizing dues-paying members, working on many issues. And I think they're going to rebuild, and I think they might even be better than the old ACORN because they're going to be learning from some of the mistakes, which I go into in the book as well. So hopefully something better will emerge.
That was John Atlas, public interest lawyer, organizer, and author of Seeds of Change, The Story of ACORN, America's Most Controversial Anti-Poverty Community Organizing Group. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Indu Anand, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.